This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of July. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. The high rate of deadly car accidents on Austin's roads this year.
Most of us don't get into crashes most of the time, and so it's easy to lull yourself into a false sense that you are invincible.
The state's top Republicans clash over the governor's veto authority.
On some level, they are all sort of establishing their positions of power.
And a review of a new Italian restaurant from people running some places that are already successful.
They have opened Easy Tiger, Arrow, which is a French bistro, and then 24 Diner.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. I hope you'll take a moment to subscribe to this podcast. Weekend.kut.org is the website you go to, and there you will find links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, RSS, so you never have to worry about missing an episode. Can you imagine such a thing? And if you have time, leave us a review in the iTunes store. You can do that in the podcasts app. You just search for KUT Weekend in iTunes and leave us a review. Helps us out a huge amount because so many people listen to podcasts through iTunes. And that's another thing that could help us out a lot. If you like this podcast, tell your friends and family about it, and maybe they'll listen too, and then they can be informed about Austin and Central Texas on a weekly basis. Finally, if you have any comments or questions, or you just want to say hello, I like Twitter. You can reach me at KUTNathan. You can email me, nathan@kut.org. If you'd rather go above my head, totally understandable. Just do news@kut.org, and that goes to a bunch of people around here. All right, so Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was in Texas this week. He was here to check out the border with Mexico. Why does the media keep talking about Donald Trump, you may ask? He's dominating the polls. He's leading the Republican field of presidential candidates by double digits in at least one poll out this week. Mind you, a lot of that polling was done before Trump made his controversial remarks about whether John McCain is a war hero. Nonetheless, that aside, he's attracting a lot of attention and support and animosity as well, of course. And when he was in Texas, he was campaigning on bringing jobs back to the U.S. and stopping illegal immigration. So let's get this report from KUT's Ben Philpott about Trump's visit to Laredo.
Trump's visit to the border was covered like a presidential event, complete with live coverage of his plane landing in Laredo on CNN. The mayor of Laredo said the town welcomed any politician with open arms. Beyond that, the response to Trump's visit skewed negative. Former governor and GOP presidential opponent Rick Perry blasted Trump for his over-the-top statements calling Mexican immigrants murderers and rapists, while Perry's supporter and the mayor of Mission, Texas, Norberto Salinas, defended the former governor's record on border security.
And we even had meetings in Monterey about how we were going to deal with the border, with the three governors in Mexico. I went personally with the governor to Monterey and had meetings about how we were going to take care of the border, and he did.
Trump made comments before landing in Texas about how unsafe he feels the border is. Texas State Senator Judith Zaffarini responded with a press release saying she hoped the visit would help Trump, quote, correct his misconceptions and eliminate his irrational fears. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
State health officials have asked for the dismissal of a lawsuit brought by undocumented immigrants. Those immigrants have been denied birth certificates for their children. Here's KUT's Jimmy Moss.
The kids were born in the United States, but local authorities refused to recognize their parents' forms of identification. Lawyers representing the Texas Department of State Health Services say in papers filed in Austin yesterday that the federal court lacks jurisdiction over claims against the state agency. 19 immigrant parents and 23 children filed suit against the state. They say officials are increasingly not recognizing consular identification cards, IDs they used to accept. Consular IDs are given by other countries to their citizens living elsewhere and don't determine legal or illegal status. The Texas agency now says such IDs cannot be verified. The parents from Mexico and Central America are not U.S. citizens. The Constitution guarantees the right of citizenship to their children because they were born in the U.S. Without a way to get a birth certificate, it leaves those parents and children in legal limbo. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
This week, city officials talked about repairing, vacating, relocating, and or demolishing a bunch of properties in Austin that don't meet
the city code. This happened at a meeting of the City of Austin's Building and Standards Commission. For years, the Austin Code Department was kind of an obscure group that not many people knew about. But as KUT's Joy Diaz tells us, Austin Code is undergoing some massive changes.
First of all, let's get one thing out of the way. Talking about the city's building codes is not sexy. But part of Jacqueline Ballone's job is to make Austinites care.
We started with television campaigns to really share and humanize, you know, our code officers so people know who they are, what they look like, you know, what the uniforms are, and why we're out there.
The department is running a full-blown PR campaign. TV ads are just one part of it. The other part is educational. For instance, there are huge signs all over Austin buses urging Austinites to call 311 if they wonder about code regulations or to report a property that may be in violation. The campaign seems to be working. More calls are coming in, but success comes with a challenge. The workload is increasing for the city's roughly 100 code officers. Matthew Noriega is one of them. With more calls, he tries to prioritize his response.
When it's a life safety issue.
That means checking up on properties that are in such disrepair, a deadly accident could happen. Like what happened at the Woodridge Apartments in Southeast Austin where balconies collapsed in 2012. Joy Diaz, KUT News.
This year, Austin's roads are more dangerous than ever. The rate of fatal car crashes is nearly double what it's been in previous years. We're only in July, and at this rate, the city will soon have more traffic fatalities this year than we did all of last year. Those statistics alone paint a pretty grim picture of road safety in Austin, but, you know, it's important to hear from the people behind those numbers. So KUT's Terrence Henry did just that.
This is Tina Michelle Pitsley.
Jake, look what I found! Come here, Jake.
That's what she sounded like at Christmas a few years ago. She was giving a present to her dog.
Can you pull that side? No? Why, because you don't have opposable thumbs? Come here.
Tina Michelle moved to Austin in 2009 to start her own business as a fitness coach. A local TV news crew did a short story on her class. In the video, you can see her pulsating and bouncing to the rhythm with a huge grin. Here's one of her students.
So much fun, and Tina is just really infectious and fun and makes you laugh.
I could run like the winds before, 5 minute miles, and you know, things. I was very, very athletic before. I was about 100 pounds of muscle before this.
This is Tina Michelle now. 2 years ago, on Memorial Day, she was out for an afternoon run. She had one last intersection to cross before she got home. The road wasn't a very busy one, and it had a stop sign before the crosswalk she was about to enter. She looked both ways, saw it was clear, and continued her run.
As I was crossing, I noticed a truck coming out of the neighborhood down the street over here. He was approaching very rapidly.
A large black Ford F-150 truck was suddenly speeding towards her.
It went black, and then I remember no feet. There was no ground underneath me anymore.
She blacked out. The crash impacted her head, shoulders, and legs.
I don't know if that's what triggered it or what, but my vision came right back right then, and I saw his rear tire rolling straight from my face.
It's been 2 years of surgeries, rehab, and piles of medical bills her and her fiancé have been struggling to pay ever since. Their plans to get married and start a family were put on hold, and her identity was altered by a traumatic brain injury in the crash.
Things are very different. I'm very different. There's things that I want to express, and I can't even get those out. I guess this is hard. Honestly, the biggest thing that I've felt is that I felt like a ghost.
She shuffles her leg now, wearing a brace. It's difficult for her to lift her foot. While she wasn't one of the over 700 Austinites killed in car crashes over the last decade, she feels like her identity has suffered a fatal crash, And what happened to Tina Michelle has been happening more and more on Austin's roads, with increasingly serious and fatal results.
I mean, there's a lot of people that suffer when somebody dies or gets seriously injured.
Art Fortune commands highway enforcement for Austin's police department. When a car crashes in Austin, his officers respond. Visiting him in his office, you'll notice a stack of papers on his desk.
So there's 10 pages, and it's front and back.
This is the list he keeps of the fatal crashes in Austin.
Location, the victim or the driver, and date of birth, a case number, and what sector of the city it occurred in.
This list will likely be twice as long by the end of the year. Fortune says they're not sure why 2015 is seeing such a drastic rise in fatal car crashes, but there are a few patterns.
Most of these fatalities do occur late at night. Most of them do occur Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
APD isn't sure that the city's new hands-free law, making it illegal to use a cell phone while driving, has made any real difference. Other causes of serious or fatal crashes are drivers speeding, ignoring stop signs, and running red lights. Intoxication is a factor in over half of the crashes, and this week the department expanded their DWI team so it's fully staffed 7 nights a week. The police could also focus more on drivers with suspended or revoked licenses. They are driving in a quarter of the fatal crashes. And prosecutors could do more. Only a handful of the dozens of fatal crashes this year have become criminal cases. But the most difficult part of reducing the fatal crashes? Changing driver behavior.
I mean, a car is a great thing, but it's also a two-ton projectile, and it can do an awful lot of damage. And we have to remind ourselves of that.
Art Markman is a psychology professor at UT Austin. He studies distracted driving and behavioral change. And he argues that what could help reduce car crashes is treating reckless or impaired driving as a public health issue. Make bad driving the new smoking.
You know, most of us don't get into crashes most of the time. And so it's easy to lull yourself into a false sense that you are invincible, that the crashes happen to someone else until they happen to you.
In an effort to promote safe driving, some cities are adopting a policy called Vision Zero. The campaign pushes a simple idea. Any road death is too many. Austin City Council adopted Vision Zero last fall and will consider an action plan to begin implementing it this November. The program started in Europe, and it uses education, enforcement, and road engineering, like making intersections safer and slowing down road speeds, to reduce fatal crashes. The idea is that crashes will still happen, but they don't have to be fatal.
If you've driven any length of time, even if you've never actually contacted another vehicle or pedestrian or anything, you have had situations in which it almost happened.
Overall, car crashes kill 3 times as many people as guns do in the U.S. It's one of the top 10 causes of preventable death in the country. And even in non-fatal crashes, like the one that hit Tina Michelle Pitsley, the consequences can last a lifetime. She's made significant recovery since being hit, regaining a lot of her speech and memory. She started doing light physical therapy at the gym, but she still doesn't feel whole.
I'm trying every day. That's the only thing that I can hang on to. I will say that I have very strong doubts, and I know there are things that will be permanent from this.
Some people tell Tina Michelle she's lucky to be alive. She says she tries to think that way, but she's not sure she always agrees. Terrence Henry, KUT News.
Been to Lake Austin when something that looks like seaweed is carpeting whole swaths of the lake? Well, it's actually an invasive species of plant. It's called hydrilla. Besides looking kind of weird, it can mess up boats, ruin recreation, and it can even damage some infrastructure. So to deal with this, the city of Austin sometimes lets loose into the lake grass carp. They eat all the hydrilla, and the carp are sterilized so they can't reproduce. But as KUT's Mos Bushell tells us, the city is now on the lookout for other unintended consequences.
Gotta hand it to the grass carp. They did their job, yeah, swimmingly. There's no hydrilla problem in the lake right now, but there is concern the thousands of hungry fish have turned their attention to native plant species and other fish.
Yeah, yes, yeah. You know, some of the anglers have talked about while they're out fishing, that they're actually able to catch grass carp on crankbaits. Well, if they're going after what looks like a shad crankbait, then they could be going after shad in general.
Dr. Brent Bellinger is an environmental scientist with Austin's Watershed Protection Department. He wants to figure out exactly what the carp are now eating and how long they'll stay in the lake. To that end, the city partnered with Texas Parks and Wildlife and area anglers to pull about 200 carp out of the lake. He says there was no visual evidence of other fish in the carp's stomach.
As far as we can tell, no. We're going to do some additional biochemical analyses to try to confirm that.
As far as native plants go, the city is trying to create special habitats to encourage their regrowth in the lake. Bellinger expects the sterilized carp will die off in time. He says their lifespan was estimated at 10 to 12 years, but scientists are running tests on the recently captured fish to see if those estimates were correct. Moz Bouchal, KET News.
Cigarette smoking has been on the decline among Americans the past couple decades, and that includes light smokers, which are people who have fewer than 5 cigarettes a day. But as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey tells us, researchers at the University of Texas at Austin have discovered that that habit is still prevalent among one group, young women.
It turns out 60% of young women under the age of 25 are light smokers. Researchers report that these women are most likely to be between the ages of 18 and 20, single, of a minority race with some years of college education. The study also found a connection between light smoking and binge drinking. Researchers did acknowledge that risky behavior, such as cigarette smoking, is common among young adults. But they also noted that female light smokers pose an added health risk, the risk to a child, should these women get pregnant and continue smoking. That being said, researchers found that light smokers were less likely to be addicted to nicotine and did not feel the need to smoke every day. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
A bit of a fight broke out this week involving the state's most powerful Republicans. It had to do with the veto powers of Governor Greg Abbott. So let me try to set this up. The state legislature passed a budget this year, right? It's well over $200 billion. Then in June, Governor Abbott vetoed more than $200 million of that $200 billion budget using his line item veto, so crossing out specific things. But some of what he vetoed are something called riders, which are instructions that state lawmakers include for state agencies to follow, spend the money in this way. But the riders themselves are not technically appropriations. So these are things that had to do with funding for the Texas Education Agency, the State Commission on the Arts, the Commission on State Emergency Communications, a bunch of state agencies. So this week, stay with me here, the Legislative Budget Board, the LBB for short, sent a letter to the comptroller. This letter accused Abbott of exceeding his authority. And I think what's really interesting about this is who's on the Legislative Budget Board and what they have to say about this. So joining us for more is Ross Ramsey, executive editor at our reporting partner, the Texas Tribune. Thank you for your time, Ross.
You bet. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, so what's going on here?
You know, it's interesting. You have a bunch of new office holders, and I think on some level, they are all sort of establishing their positions of power. On another level, this is, you know, a real sort of managerial battle over who gets to do what. The governor has the power in the Constitution to veto line items in the budget. He could say, I don't like this particular expense, knock it out, and to go through the budget with a pen like that. But there are some descriptive sections of the state budget called riders. And there's a question of whether you can actually veto a rider. And if you veto a rider, are you into the legislature's territory? Legislators use those things to direct agencies to describe policies, and they maintain that those are not appropriations that the governor has the power to veto.
Now, he received a letter from the Legislative Budget Board's executive director, Ursula Parks. Who is on the Legislative Budget Board, the LBB?
Well, this is interesting. The Legislative Budget Board is not an executive agency. It's a legislative agency. And the co-chairs are House Speaker Joe Strauss and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. The members are 4 members of the House and 4 members of the Senate, including the 2 who write the state budget.
You point out in your piece today, Ross, that an Abbott spokesperson, John Whitman, said that it's unfortunate that unelected bureaucrats at the LBB are more concerned with protecting their own turf than complying with the line item veto authority conferred on the governor. But as you point out, you know, a lot of these people on the LBB are not unelected bureaucrats.
Well, she is the executive director of the agency, but she is directed by, you know, 10 members of the legislature. It's a legislative agency. So unless she made a career move and her bosses are cranky about it, she's fine. Now, that goes to the next thing. Dan Patrick put out a press release that basically said he's cranky about it. He doesn't agree with her on this, doesn't think she should have done it. Joe Strauss's spokesman said that the lieutenant governor's staff and the speaker's staff talked about this last week and decided to send a memo that was requested by the controller. So we basically got everybody, you know, spitting and clawing at each other. And I think you go back to the initial thing, which is each of them is trying to determine where the power in this lies. Does it lie with the legislature or with the governor?
And is this part of Abbott's effort to broaden the powers of the governor's office in some way?
Well, I don't know if they would specifically describe it that way, but you know, he's a new governor. We've had Rick Perry in office for so long that you forget that a new guy has to figure out where the fence lines are. What can he get away with? Where does he get stopped? He was the state's top lawyer and has a pretty good idea of some of this stuff. One of the citations in the letter from the LBB was from a Greg Abbott opinion that they read to mean that he can't do the vetoes that he vetoed. So I think there's a lot more fight left in this.
What are some of the possible outcomes, Ross? Could Abbott see some of his vetoes vanish into thin air?
I think he could. You know, there's about $200 million in vetoes in question here. If you read the letter the way the LBB wrote it, it is, you know, those vetoes were basically illegal and can't be enforced. If you read this the way Abbott obviously intended it, that $200 million won't get spent. Ultimately, it's up to the controller to write the checks, but I suspect the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, will be asked for an opinion somewhere along the way.
Right. And I just got off the phone with the comptroller's office, and they said they're still reviewing things and didn't really have much of a comment. So,
yeah, I think, you know, everybody who's a non-combatant in this thing or is on the side of this thing is hoping not to get a punch thrown at them. I think Glenn Hager's probably in that category.
Ross Ramsey is executive editor at the Texas Tribune. Thanks for your time, Ross.
Thank you.
Starting in January, you can legally carry a handgun in public in Texas. You can have it holstered on your hip if you have a permit. And later next year, if you have a permit, you can carry a concealed handgun on state university campuses. But there are still a few places in Texas that are strictly gun-free, like hospitals, for example. And some Second Amendment advocates want to change that. As Lauren Silverman tells us, a North Texas lawmaker is calling for staff and visitors to be allowed to bring firearms into hospitals.
A few years ago, when State Representative Drew Springer went to visit a deputy at a Fort Worth hospital, he had to leave his gun in his car.
I go up and see the deputy, and then I come back, and now I leave where the security guard is, and I spend the next 10 minutes walking in a dark parking lot to get to my car in downtown Fort Worth, and I absolutely did not feel safe.
Springer says it makes no sense. He can take his gun into the Capitol building, but has to leave it in the glove compartment before walking into the ER. So the representative proposed a bill to eliminate most gun-free zones in the state. His district stretches over several counties between Amarillo and Dallas-Fort Worth, and it includes more than a dozen hospitals.
I've had both employees as well as visitors of their loved ones that have said, you know, we're right here on the interstate. There's a big sign that says hospital, and people are coming off and trying to rob them of their drugs, and they feel vulnerable, and they want the right to be able to protect themselves.
Police Captain Dan Burbeck is also a Second Amendment supporter, but says guns should be off limits in hospitals. He's responsible for the team that responds to emergencies in the Dallas County Hospital District.
I totally understand the public's want or need to be able to defend themselves. However, I think there needs to be some common sense built into this as well.
Burbeck says Parkland, like many other major hospitals, treats a large number of psychiatric patients who may be in danger of hurting themselves or others.
With open carry or concealed carry, you have a well-intentioned patient coming in, sitting next to psych patients and prisoners, and you've introduced a gun into that environment. Even though that person, you know, may have a right to defend themselves, they don't have the right to place others in danger.
Which is exactly what happened several years ago when Parkland doctors were treating a prisoner.
He ended up overpowering a deputy sheriff and was able to take his firearm.
After a large manhunt, a SWAT team eventually took the prisoner into custody. More recently, in January, a shooting at a Veterans Affairs clinic in El Paso left a psychologist and the gunman dead. In April, a father visiting his son at a hospital in Harris County pulled a gun on a nurse. In that incident, no one was hurt. Still, these cases bring up safety concerns for staff and visitors. In fact, new research released by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration shows staff working in hospitals experience much higher rates of workplace violence. The solution, says Steve Love with the Dallas-Fort Worth Hospital Council, isn't more weapons.
All people that I know within the hospital community clearly want gun-free zones in their hospitals.
Love says there's already violence without guns.
You know, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, and this wasn't even a gun, we had a nurse at the Good Shepherd Hospital over in Longview lose her life, where she was killed with a knife by a visitor in a hospital.
Hospitals across North Texas train for violence like active shooter incidents. Here's Police Captain Dan Burbeck.
If we were to have somebody enter the hospital with a gun with, you know, their objectives or intention is to kill people or shoot people, we have non-ambulatory patients that can't defend themselves. We have patients that are ill and unable to defend themselves. So we try to prepare so that we can protect as many of our patient population as possible.
Lawmaker Drew Springer says he's willing to negotiate the details of guns in hospitals, but he doesn't plan to drop the issue.
That's Lauren Silverman with Dallas Public Radio Station, KERA.
If you've been crying for more Italian food options in Austin, the city is getting them. About half a dozen Italian restaurants slated to open this year, and one of the first is a place called Italic. And that's also the subject of the latest review by Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom, who's here with me now. Hey, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
So who's behind Italic?
Italic is the Elm Restaurant Group. You might know them. Their executive chef is Drew Curran. They have opened Easy Tiger, which is a bakehouse and beer garden there on 6th Street, near I-35. They opened Arrow, which is a French bistro further down on West 6th Street. And then near West 6th Street and Lamar Boulevard, they have 24 Diner.
Where is Italic?
Italic is in the ground floor of the Star Building, which is that mid-century building at Colorado and 6th Street on the south side of 6th Street.
Okay. What are they doing there?
Well, when you think Italy and Italian food, I think we often think rustic. And so they're kind of taking, I think, a rustic approach to Italian cuisine. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite go with the space there. It's this big, kind of sparse mid-century building. It's very loud. The design is kind of spare and modernist. And so it doesn't quite go with where the cuisine is trying to go.
Well, what are your overall impressions of the cuisine?
You know, they do a half chicken with arugula, pistachio, pesto that's really nice, if not a little bit oily. The chicken was extremely tender. I really like that. They also roast some pork that they put on a sandwich at lunchtime using the bread that they have from Easy Tiger, and that's fantastic bread. They also have an all-Italian wine list, which is great. The wine is actually presented in a beautiful case atop a stairwell in the middle of the building. It's probably the coolest design element of that space.
What about pizzas?
You know, unfortunately, in the three times I went there, I ran into some problems trying to get pizza. One afternoon, they said that there had been a problem with the dough in the morning and to come back that night or the next day. We went back the next day and ordered three pizzas, and they only had enough dough for one pizza. The good news is that pizza was really nice. It had this golden oiled crust to it, nice pliancy, some good sausage and peppers, gooey mozzarella. So I really enjoyed the pizza. I just wish I could have had a little bit more of it.
But reading your review, it doesn't seem like you loved everything.
Yeah, I think it's struggling to find its footing. The pasta dishes I had there are really gloomy, over-peppered. Carbonara was not great. The lasagna at lunch was a bit chewy. So I had some problems with the pasta dishes, which you want to kind of be a hallmark of an Italian restaurant. So I guess it didn't quite meet my expectations. As you mentioned, there's more Italian restaurants coming, so we'll see what happens down the line.
Well, yeah, talk to me about those places. You mentioned them in your review. What other Italian restaurants can we expect in 2015?
Well, Juliet recently opened in the old Romeo's spot, appropriately enough, different owner, right there on Barton Springs Road on that little restaurant row, which has some chef veterans from the Austin scene. I haven't dipped in there yet because it's a little too early for me, but hearing some good things about that. Juniper over on East Cesar Chavez is from a veteran of the Uchi restaurants, so I'm interested to see how that goes. And then Alfico is from the owner of Vino Vino, and that's also going to be over on the east side, and that's slated to open sometime this year as well. So it sounds like people have finally heard the cry for more Italian restaurants.
Well, you are a longtime Austinite. You also used to live in Italy. You love Italian food. Where do you go now to get a great Italian meal in Austin?
Yeah, there's several places I like to go. I like to go to La Traviata on Congress and 3rd Street. They do great pasta. I really like their carbonara. I go to Vespaio, of course. That's an old standby, a stalwart on South Congress for over a decade. They do a great panzotti di zucca, which is butternut squash and sage brown butter.
Just sounds delicious the way you say it.
And their lasagna, of course, is everybody knows about their lasagna. It's great. You're going to want to take a nap after that. Next door, their little sister Inateca makes really nice pizzas. You go up north to Andiamo. They do a bunch of different things. The thing I really like, really simple, is their cacio e pepe spaghetti.
Which is a pretty simple dish, right?
Yeah, cheese and pepper.
Okay, well, you can read Matthew Odom's full review of Italic at austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew, thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
That, my friends, is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of July. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast very easily, weekend.kut.org. Tell your friends and family members about it. If you have any questions, email news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then